Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're sitting at the International Culinary Center, and my guests are none other than Deanne and Rick Bayless from Chicago. They're in for the Beard Awards, of course, as they are every year, and so welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to see your beautiful school.
Oh, thank you. So for those of you, all three of you out there who might not know who these people are, they are food royalty in this country. They're from Chicago, where they reign the city, and it goes way back. Rick was chosen as Best New Chef in 1988 by Food & Wine magazine. The James Beard Foundation named him Best American Chef in 1991. Then he became the National Chef of the Year in 1995. He's got cookbooks, I think about four, everything from Rick Bayless's Mexican Kitchen to Mexico One Plate at a Time. And I think both of those won the James Beard Cookbook of the Year awards. And
well, we've won a lot of awards, yes.
Yes, you have. Best Chef Midwest. Oh, come on. I can go on and on and on. And other people might know him from his TV show. But now we're going to get to know the real Rick Bayless and Deanne, who I don't think people realize how much Deanne is a force in their restaurants and in their Frontier of Foods lines and everything they do together, PBS shows. And I'm not sure, I think everyone's intrigued by this relationship. So this is going to be a dual interview. And Deanne, you tend to be very quiet, and I don't want you to be. All right. I want to hear from you. Okay, so welcome, guys.
Thank you very much.
All right, so tell me where each of you were born and what was really your first food memories that got you into food?
I was born in a suburb of Chicago, and in my first food memories let's just say they're not too exciting. I'm 100% Dutch, and I was born, my parents moved to the suburbs. It was a big deal to get out of the city from the area where all the Dutch people live, move to the suburbs and live. They did that because they wanted the schools, they wanted the space, they wanted everything. So it was the beginning of the suburban movement. So I'm very much from that time. And my father went on a train into the city to work every day. We sat down as a family. My memories are actually sitting down to eat, which is an anomaly these days. But we sat down three meals a day, breakfast on Saturday, lunch when we were home on Saturday, and dinner, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We ate as a family, and my mother was not a good cook, but we sat around the table.
So what got you into cooking?
First of all, I love to eat. That helps. And then I realized how much fun you can have around food and cooking and being with your friends and doing that. I was, ironically enough, very well known for my taco parties when I was in college.
And where did this Mexico thing come in Chicago?
That was not Mexican food.
It was not Mexican food, tacos. That's why I said ironically. But okay. The ground beef with a seasoning mix and greasy fried bad tortillas. But that's all I knew. But it was fun, and we put all these things on them, and we always had fun around it. My mother, bless her heart, would let me cook, although she'd run around cleaning up after every little thing I did. But anyway, it was a great time, and I love to eat. And then I really love creating special moments around the table. That's my thing. And I realized that just loving to cook is very different than knowing how to cook. That I actually realized that when I really got to know Rick, and I like to cook, but I wouldn't consider myself a great cook at all.
So where did you go to school?
I went to college in Wheaton College, which is in Wheaton, Illinois, and then I went to...
Which is where you grew up.
Which is where I grew up, yes. And I lived... My father had just died. I wanted to be close to my mother. I was the last kid at home, and so I stayed around there, and then I went to graduate school at University of Michigan.
What did you study?
That's where we met. I got a degree first in English, then I lived in Asia for a year, then I...
Oh, where'd you live in Asia?
I was in Taiwan teaching in a school for American kids. It was the height of the Vietnam War, so it was military and missionary kids. It was half and half, and then I came back and went back to Ann Arbor because I loved it and stayed around and got a degree in theater and sort of lived there, and that's where we met. We both went to school a lot because we liked it.
That's what I keep saying all day today. I want to go back to school. I love learning.
To me,
it's the most exciting thing in the world is to get up every day and know you're going to learn something. And when you see a curriculum like what you have here at the school, and it's so organized, and I like that kind of learning. Mm-hmm. I like the practical, just hanging out and watching people do things, but I love to move through a curriculum as well because you can master so much more so quickly. So every classroom that I've been in today, I just wanted to go put my coat on and just join with the students there.
My gosh, you're so humble. I think you can teach the classes.
If I had learned technology, like Lainey does so naturally now, if I had learned it, starting in a curriculum sense, starting from the beginning, I would be so much better. But you came in at some level and you learned, okay, if I hit this, this will happen, you know, and so I never got the whole picture. That's where I really saw the difference between an organized way through some kind of education and not.
Well, education is really about being a great editor and a great communicator.
Without a doubt.
Because everything you study is just so huge. But that's not about you. This is Chef's Story.
Let's go back to Chef's Story.
So, Rick, I think you were born in Oklahoma City.
I was born in Oklahoma City, family of food people, restaurant people. I'm fourth generation in that my great-grandparents were the first grocers in the state of Oklahoma and had a chain of grocery stores. And then the next generation was half grocers and half people that went into restaurants to use the groceries, and the next generation was all restaurants, and so that's what I grew up with. And my family, there were many different kinds of restaurants, nothing too fancy. The fanciest thing that we had in our family was a steakhouse, but my parents... My father married into this food family, and he decided after trying a number of career options that he was going to also join the ranks of the restaurant world, and so he opened up a barbecue restaurant. And barbecue is really the sort of regional cuisine of the area. So I grew up with this sense of cooking with wood, which is still, it permeates everything that I do. I love all kinds of live fire cooking, and a sense of tradition, because we would go as a family to different places in the state of Oklahoma or in Texas just to eat barbecue, and just with the sole purpose of coming back and saying, see, ours is better. So we had this really great sense of pride in our cuisine, what we did. And it was a very simple cuisine. Well, simple in one way. It was simple because it never really changed very much, and the ingredients for the cuisine that I grew up on were available year-round. But it was really hard in another way, because you had to know precisely how to season that barbecue sauce and how to dry rub and marinate the meats and how to slow cook them and what the temperature. We had a brick pit, and we had no way of judging the temperature except to put your hand in it. So we didn't have thermometers or anything. So you really had to have that refined appreciation for temperature placement, where the wood was in it and all of that. And I guess growing up on that, it led me to an appreciation when I went to Mexico and just fell madly in love with the culture.
So how old were you when you went to Mexico?
I was 14, my first trip to Mexico. And there was a sense when I got there that somehow I had come home, that it was just the right place for me. And I continued.
Which part of Mexico were you?
Well, I was a sort of precocious kid, okay? So I now think my mother really put up with a whole lot. I was always wanting to.
I agree with that.
I was always wanting to do.
She agrees with that too. His mother,
yes.
By the way.
I wanted to do things that were way beyond my years. So at 14, I planned our first family vacation where we were going to get on an airplane. We'd always driven wherever we were going to go for our family vacations, and so I planned this trip, first time out of the country, first time on an airplane as a family, and we went to Mexico City. And at 14, I planned the whole thing. I made all the airline reservations. I booked the hotels. And this is before you could do any of that stuff online.
Right.
So it was a big deal. I planned our whole itinerary.
I don't even think they had phones back then.
Yeah, right. We sent up smoke signals. Yes, that's how old I am. Anyway, we went there. I fell madly in love. Figured out a way to get back there pretty much every year. Majored in Spanish language and literature and Latin American studies in college. Then went, I went to University of Oklahoma for my undergrad degree, and then I followed a professor to University of Michigan to study anthropology and linguistics, because I was really, really interested in the way that a language expresses its culture. So I was really interested in culture, but then I got so into language studies, I thought that's the way I wanted to go. And at that point, I knew I didn't want to inherit my parents' restaurant. It wasn't going to be right for me at all. So I decided to take this career in academics.
Wait. So how did they feel about that? Because it was fourth generation, did you say?
Yeah. You know, I think for a number of reasons that it... My mother's always said that my father died when I was in high school, which actually... that was another thing that sort of really... taught me so many things, because my mother took over the restaurant when my father died, and I took over the catering business at 16. Now, it was sort of barbecue-style catering, so you probably can imagine what that's like. We had our barbecued meats, and we put them out in chafing dishes, and we had a lot of cold and hot things, and we set up a buffet. So all I had to do was go out, make sure everything was there, serve it, take care of the guests and all that. And I would oftentimes do a whole party for 40 people by myself, because it was a kind of buffet. And what I learned in all of that was how to take care of people, how to make sure that everything looked beautiful, how to ensure that your guests are just having a really memorable time. And when you cater barbecue, it's usually for something... Well, like a lot of catering for a special occasion, but in our place, barbecue meant you were doing something that had deep roots in your community. So you were usually celebrating a community-wide sort of thing. So you wanted to make sure that barbecue was perfect, you know? So I got a sense of that growing up, and then decided I wanted to go away from it. But, you know, there was something, and I always tell all cooks this. A lot of people come to me and they'll say, you know, I say, I love to cook. I love it. I think I really want to become a chef. And I say, the only time you should become a chef is if you can't not do it. And I always say, there's a double negative in that for a reason. Because there, I tried to get away from it, and all I found myself doing was cooking. Just going back and cooking, and I cooked every day. And I had a group that I cooked with in my graduate department in linguistics, and we didn't have, none of us had any money. So every week, one of us would have this big dinner to do it about once every 6 or 8 weeks. And we would spend a whole week just cooking and making sure that this was going to be great, buying cheap wine because that was all we could afford. And it was the only time we had wine anyway. So it was a really amazing experience for me. But it taught me that as much as I loved my studies, the passion that was in me was really for cooking. And so I took the infamous year off from graduate school. I was working on my dissertation. I had passed all my prelims. I had done all my coursework. And I was in the middle of writing my dissertation for my PhD. And all I wanted to do was cook. And I finally decided I was going to take the year off. I started doing writing about food. I opened a catering business. I started teaching cooking. And teaching cooking was really interesting because for almost 3 years, I made almost my whole life just teaching in avocational cooking schools, because this was back in the 70s, and there were all of these cooking shops popping up everywhere. And in the back of every one of these cooking and kitchenware shops, there was a little demo kitchen. So I could just make my living from just popping from one to the next and teaching classes. And what a lot of people don't know know about me is that I actually started off in pastry. And I taught pastry classes.
Wow.
I was completely self-taught.
What? Did you have a sweet tooth?
Yeah.
I always. Yeah, one would say. I learned that from my mother. She always planned every meal from dessert backwards.
Yeah.
She always would decide what
their
the
family's
was.
Infamous.
Yes. Uh-huh. There's always got to be dessert at every meal.
Okay.
It's hilarious. But I started by teaching pastry. I was self-taught because this was in the years when there weren't very many cooking schools.
Many.
I mean, CIA existed and a couple of others. I was living in Ann Arbor and there was Schoolcraft College, but it was very different. You didn't go to Schoolcraft College unless, I mean, it was like the career choice was, am I going to go into woodworking, automotive, become a chef at this college?
I don't think they called them chefs, though.
No, it was cooks. You were cooks. It was really interesting. But anyway, so I didn't go to that school. And I didn't really think that there was a whole lot it had to teach me because I was really interested in high-level cuisine, and I had read every single thing that Julia Child had ever written. At 14, I got my first copy of a Julia Child cookbook, and I got Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Volume 1, and I cooked every single thing in it.
You were the original Julia.
I was, but I was just a teenage kid cooking.
That would have been a more interesting movie.
It probably would have been. It would have been pretty hilarious if you had seen the looks on the faces of my parents when I would make undercooked green beans, because I grew up in the place where you cook green beans for 4 hours on the back of the stove with a piece of salt pork in there.
Right.
And here I was blanching and shocking green beans, you know, and it was...
Did they not like it and just say
no, basically they didn't like hardly anything that I made, but I loved it. And
right.
Julia,
they ate it.
I took chefs up to my ancestral home in Nova Scotia it's a lobster village. And the chef started cooking the lobster, and the local, my relatives up there, all sitting around, and they go, Dorothy, you see what he's doing to the lobster? The boy don't know how to cook lobster. To this day, that was probably 30 years ago, to this day they talk about those New York chefs that don't know how to cook lobster.
It's terrible.
You know, because it's a little undercooked. They cook it a lot longer. And they still say, oh, you killed us that day.
Yes.
You know, and it was delicious, absolutely. Anyway, so I'm thinking the green beans had the same fate.
It sort of was that way. And there were a lot of other examples of just that same thing.
So now how did the two of you meet? And then did you open a restaurant right away?
No, we weren't sure we wanted to do anything of that nature. I was looking for an apartment. I called from Oklahoma City. I was going to fly up to rent an apartment in Ann Arbor. And Deanne is the first person that I talked to because she was an administrative assistant in a church. And the professor that I was going to study with at University of Michigan, he was involved in that church, and he said, well, I'll tell you, just call this woman, and she'll help figure it out with you. And so she was the first person that I ever talked to, and I met her there. And we didn't get together until a number of years later, but once we started dating, it was all about food, okay? Because by this point, I was... I was in this infamous year off of graduate school, and Deanne hosted a birthday party for a mutual friend, and I got there, and it was the most wonderful spread of food, and I thought, who made this food? And so I asked her, and she said she did. So it actually... the way to a man's heart is through his stomach in this story as well. So it was kind of funny.
Now the story from my perspective. Yeah.
Come on, Deanne.
I loved giving dinner parties. I was not a great cook, but I loved planning the whole event. So I had this friend, and we had another mutual friend who had a good job, and he could afford to buy the ingredients because I didn't have any money for the ingredients. So he said, I'll get them and you make the party. So I planned this very elaborate thing, and I got up in the morning, probably late, you know, Saturday morning, started to cook, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, this is a lot of work. And meanwhile, I had a roommate who got up and said, well, I'll cook with you. So she bailed me out. We cooked together all day. She was much better than I was. I made a really pretty ring mold with flowers in it to float something.
It was ice, an ice ring mold with flowers frozen in it.
See, I always like the flowers.
Oh, my gosh. This is so sweet.
And this is a really long time ago, yes.
Yeah, we've been married, what, 34, 35 years? Somewhere in there. But anyway, so this party was a great success. Yeah. And I wooed a man. It was not really, I was not intentionally after him, but I knew he was coming, and I thought, this is good.
Yeah.
So what did your parents think of each other when they met? Did they say this is a match made in heaven?
Oh, no. Actually, well, we had a very whirlwind romance that...
They were all shocked.
They were all shocked. We didn't tell anyone, either family, that we were even seeing each other.
Why? I mean...
I don't know. It was just, I think we had... Something happened and we fell madly in love and were totally consumed with one another for about 3 months. And then when we told each other, each family that we were together, we actually said, we're not just together, but we're engaged and we're going to get married in 3 months. So we went from the first serious date to married in 6 months.
Wow.
It was pretty fast.
So what else did you connect on with? Food. Was it literature, anthropology?
It was pretty much all of those things. Because
and travel.
Travel, we both. I hadn't really had the opportunity to travel very much, and Deanne grew up with a family that was scattered all over the globe, and so she had traveled all over the place.
But not to Mexico.
But never to Mexico. We got married, and we went on buses for 6 weeks through Mexico.
Why did you decide to do that?
This is another kind of crazy part of the
there
courtship.
Was a fateful day.
There was a fateful day
at the kitchen sink.
After Deanne had made avocado and grapefruit salad for me for
stuffed
lunch.
In an avocado
yes,
shell.
This was very special.
70s.
Very 70s and very special. And I thought that was really nice. And then this was the time that I sort of proposed to her.
Sort of.
This is, okay.
No,
so here's the deal.
No
here's,
ring, but you know.
Like that. It was basically, I wanted to either go, because remember, I had an undergrad degree in Latin American studies and had studied in Mexico and loved Mexico. But then I had been teaching French cooking and French pastries, kind of making my living with that. I had a catering business. We mostly did French food. So I had really immersed myself in that. So I decided I wanted to go away and really study something. So I said to Deanne, I really want to do it. I either want to go to move to Paris, and I knew that I had a bunch of contacts at the La Varenne School in Paris, which is no longer there, unfortunately. But back in the 70s, that was a big deal. And if you committed to 6 months, you got your degree as a stagiaire there, you would help out. And you would get your 6 month degree.
Right.
So I thought I could maybe do that, but it was really expensive to live in Paris. Or we could go off to Mexico and do stuff, and we could last a lot longer in Mexico. And so I said to Deanne, I want to go one place or another. Will you go with me? And she said, is this a proposal of marriage?
Romantic.
Yes, Deanne comes from a very conservative family, and that just going off with me would not have been looked at in a very good way. So
we're talking the 70s.
That's right. So anyway,
were you flower children in any way, shape, or form?
You know,
I think I've seen pictures of you, Deanne, with flowers in your hair.
Yeah,
I can remember some of those pictures.
More in clothing than anything else. I never participated in some of the aspect of that world.
I said, well, yeah. So I said, let's go. And so we decided to get married, and then we immediately packed everything up and went off to Mexico for 6 weeks.
That on second-class buses, I might add.
Yes, it was.
No romantic
spa. The truth of the matter, I didn't understand... that this would have to be a test of this marriage, to take somebody who's never been to Mexico before all through Mexico on buses. And
in the 70s.
I guess I was really naive about that. But anyway, we came back. We were still married. And I guess, you know, that has
meant what was the next step? You came back. Did you expect that you were going to open a restaurant or
no.
work in a restaurant?
Actually, I was interested in food writing. And so I came back and we both worked, and I got a job doing consulting work for one restaurant, which lost its chef right when it opened. And they said, would you come to Cleveland for a year? Well, they asked me permanently, would you move to Cleveland and be the chef of this restaurant? And I said, I'll come for 1 year because I wanted to save up money to really go back to Mexico for a long time. And so we did that. And Deanne moved with me to Cleveland for a year, got a really good job. We saved every penny. And then we decided we were going to move to Mexico. And we were just going to live there for a year. We had saved up enough money that we thought we could last for a year. And I was going to write a book on regional Mexican cooking in a year. Well, we were very lucky that we were offered a part-time consulting gig for a chain of Mexican-American restaurants in Los Angeles, just literally when we were walking out the door to move to Mexico. And that's what allowed us. My first book, Authentic Mexican, is a book that we did over a long period of time because the cuisine is so complex that I was foolish to think I could move to Mexico and in a year produce a book. And we actually ended up spending 5 years working on that book. But we had this half-time gig. We could work, we could live in Mexico for a month and then come back to LA and work for a month. And that's the way we financed our first book.
All right, so we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to hear about the next chapter.
All right.
Young years.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guests are Deanne and Rick Bayless from Chicago, Frontera Grill and Topolobampo, and we're just hearing about the honeymoon in Mexico, and we're going to move on now to how did you get into not only the restaurant industry, but this empire, this food empire you've been building, and media empire?
Well, none of it was really planned. It always was done one step at a time, whatever seemed to be the right next step. And we finished that book, Authentic Mexican. About halfway through, we had written a lot of the book and sent it to an editor, or we had an agent who sent it to an editor, and it was bought by the great cookbook editor, Maria Guarnaschelli, who had done amazing, amazing work, amazing, had edited really incredible books. And she really understood my academic background because she has an academic background as well. So she loved really well-researched books, and I think that's the reason she bought it. So we turned it all in, and then it was turned back to us within about 6 or 8 weeks, and she basically said, I need half of this book. It was super long. And she said, I need you to cut it in half. And that was the hardest thing I think I've ever done in the writing world, was cut it in half.
Oh, my God. It was painful.
So what part were you playing, Deanne, in this? How do you work together? Oh, what's this working relationship like?
Yeah, it's always been the same.
He writes. He thinks things up. usually you cook it, you test. These days we have test somebody in our staff that tests, but in the, that day, you cooked almost everything, and I edit, organize, produce. In our world, he's the creative and I'm the producer. That's sort of in everything we do. It's how our personalities play out.
Do you basically do everything together? I mean, if you get, like with the TV media, you're on air. Are you in the background?
I'm completely. She's the producer.
You're the producer.
No, it's
the,
our relationship developed from the really early stages that we both had different areas of responsibility and really respected each other's abilities to do things. I think a lot of people, when they see what is typically called the talent in front, you know, of the camera or with the name on the cover or whatever like that, they somehow think that that person can do everything, and it's not true at all. Every person that has some sort of front talent needs really strong producer, editor, whatever that person is that's behind, that's really keeping the whole thing going. And I think I always say that most of my success has been due to the fact that Deanne is such a great producer, and she has really can see the whole picture and is never shy about questioning, is this the right thing to do, or is this the right length of something to do, or, you know, are we going down the right path here, and making me stop and think, because I'm one of those people who gets really excited about the next project, and I'll just go headlong into it, sometimes without thinking about the whole picture, and DM's always great to be able to
say that.
So tell
me, in your early days with the restaurant, restaurants are so notoriously hard to make successful. You're in a very tough, demanding market of Chicago.
Yeah.
Did you have to struggle at any of these points? And, you know, we only have 45 minutes before I'm like speeding it up to from LA to, how'd you get from LA to Chicago? That may be
we didn't awesome. Like living in LA, and we didn't want to settle there, even though we could have opened our restaurant. By the time that we finished that book, we were already thinking about, you know, people don't understand this regional Mexican food. We should open a restaurant. We know how to make it. We should open a restaurant and show people what it tastes like. Just putting it in a book wasn't enough for me. And because I had a restaurant background, I thought, let's bring this stuff to life. Let's put it in a restaurant setting.
Why Chicago?
That's where Deanne's family was, and all of our stuff was stored there, and we didn't have enough money to move it anywhere. So we decided
we wanted to be in a major metropolitan area.
But did you think that Chicago was going to get it? I mean,
you know, I love Chicago because it's a very loyal city. If you give them something interesting at a fair price, because it's a fairly price-conscious city, and consistency, they will keep coming back to you all the time. And we didn't know whether our restaurant was going to have to be, remember, this is the beginning of the Southwestern movement and everything. We didn't know whether our restaurant was going to have to sort of play to the Southwestern thing, or if we could stay in the regional Mexican thing. So we started off with an initial menu that had nods to Southwestern cuisine. We took them off within 6 or 8 weeks because people were all, our book had come out. They really wanted to see what is the regional Mexican stuff that we were writing about. So we had sort of instant credibility when the book came out, and then the restaurant opened literally the same day. The publication date was the opening date for the restaurant.
Wow.
That was not planned.
No. It could never have happened. If you had planned it, it wouldn't have worked out. Yeah, no. But it just happened.
So the restaurant was a success early on.
It was a huge success. Yeah. We had done a pro forma for what we thought we were going to make and how long it was going to take us to pay back all the people who we don't have any partners, but we had people who lent us money. Deanne's mother, yes, you should never open a restaurant borrowing money from your mother-in-law, okay? Or from your mother, my own mother's retirement fund.
I know.
Okay, that's like you'd never do that. But we did it because that was what we had to do.
Yeah.
And then we had another friend that lent us money, and we figured out how long it was going to take us to pay it back. Well, with our pro forma, we figured in 2 years we could get it paid back. We hit our 6 month projections at 6 weeks, and at 6 months, we were into territory we couldn't even imagine that the restaurant could run. And so we paid off everything in a year.
But the problem was we started with not very much staff, so we really were working a lot.
No, we started
understaffed, and that's one of the reasons all the money was there. We weren't paying anybody. We were just working.
Right. And we really had those days that you hear about where I would take the bus to the restaurant in the morning, and I would open the door at 8 o'clock in the morning for all the cooks to come in, and then I would work the lunch shift, and then I would go and lie down on a banquette for about an hour in the middle of the afternoon, and then I would work the evening shift, and I was just a line cook. I mean, I couldn't even stand on the outside of the line and expedite. I actually stood behind the line and worked one of the positions and cleaned my own station at the end of the night, and then I would go and lie down on the banquette again and wait for Deanne to close up at night, and then she'd wake me up and we'd get in the car and we'd drive home,
That
was usually 3 in the morning. That I'd take a few more hours of sleep and then get up and take the bus down so she could have the car to drive the next day. I mean, we did that for a long time.
About a year.
And then we were closed on Sundays and Mondays, so we would sleep all day Sunday. And then we would go in and do the things on Monday that we couldn't get to during the week. So it was...
Isn't it to start a business?
Especially if you don't have, like, big money. We didn't have any reputation in Chicago, so we figured we were coming into a town that is really well-known for large restaurant groups. And so the Let Us Entertain You people were really at their peak at that time. And I thought to myself, because when you've got your parents... retirement stuff on the line here, you got to be successful. And I thought, how can we stand apart from those groups? And I said, well, the only way we can do it is by being really personal, because those restaurants can never be personal because the owners aren't really there. And so as Deanne and I were there all the time, and we said hi to all of our guests, and we made sure that they were happy. Though I have to say that the first, and I think this is really, really an important thing for all of our listeners to keep in mind, that the first customers that came into our restaurant, the very first ones, sat down, looked at the menu, closed the menu, got up, walked out, and said, "You guys will be closed within a week. There is nothing I want to eat on this menu." That was our first customers. So we stuck with it, though, because I had a vision that this could be really successful, and I knew all I had to do was communicate it in the right way to our guests so that it sounded like something they wanted to eat. And so that's why I think it's so important how you write menu copy.
Well, you know, Lydia Bastianich says the same thing about, you know, Italian food with spaghetti and meatballs, you know, and for her to bring her style of Northern Italian, who's right. The same kind of thing. Okay, we're going to have to take another little break, and we'll be back in a minute.
All right.
Listening to Chef's Story. Today's guest is Deanne and Rick Bayless. So you've worked your tails off, and it's, you know, it's not, even when you do have help, it's still a long, arduous restaurant business. And now little Lainey comes along, that I think most people know from the TV shows. Mm-hmm. How hard is it to have a child and be a restaurant couple?
Well,
I think there's a lot of people out there. I know with our students, this is a very big question, especially among women. So, you know, aside from being anecdotal about this, you two have raised, and I know her, one of the most wonderful young women, you know. How did you do it, and what is it like? I think there's a lot of men and women out there in the industry who would like to know your secret.
I think that there's this many solutions to that whole question as there are people, but our solution was very simple. We said we only wanted to do it if we could figure out how to integrate her into the world that we worked in all the time. And so we figured it out by having a room set aside rent in Chicago is expensive, not nearly like New York. So we could carve out a little room, and we called it our family room. And that's where she could be, and we could be with
her. At the restaurant.
At the restaurant.
It was just a storage space.
Yeah, it was a storage space, right. And then, and so, I don't know, I just, you know when you're, when that... You're young. I mean, we weren't so young.
I was actually
42.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. So, but it's like you get an idea going in your mind and you say, I know I can make this work. I'm sure I can. So anyway, we went. She was born. I am not a stay-at-home type. So I was back to work with her when she was 3 days old. We walked back in the restaurant for the first time. You can still see the kitchen staff all in the back cheering for us. But then, we're in command of our own schedule, I could be there, work, but if I had to run and be with her, or if I had to go nurse her, or whatever it was, I just did it. And then when she was awake, we'd wear her. Rick wore her working on the
line. I tried not to, like, do the sauté station with her hanging in one of those things in front. But actually, there were a few times that I had to. And I had to take care. And there was Frontera and Topolo Ampo share a kitchen, but they're sort of, it's a kind of a line that's a mirror image of one another. So you can walk directly from one line to the other. And between those two lines, I had this small desk where I could, it was really tiny, but it was a place that I could make notes and stuff like that, and I could be right on the line but have a desk. And I found that really useful to be able to do all the work that I wanted to do. And so I got this little carrying thing for Lainey when she was really young, and I could nestle her into my desk, and she could sleep there, and I could just work the line. And then if I needed to step off, I could get another cook to cover me for a minute while I was taking care of her. Now, I have to say, we recognize the fact that we own our own restaurant, and we could make any choices that we wanted to. But to this very day, we have customers come up to us and say, how's Lainey? I remember when you used to carry her in a pack on the front of the line. Or I remember when she took her first steps, because it was all done at the restaurant. It was a big celebration for us. In the restaurant business, one of the things that we always try to do is create community. And we create community in several different groups. Of course, we want to create a community feel for the guests that come into the restaurant. That when you walk in there, there is a sense that you're at somebody's home, just like what Jacques Pepin said at the awards last night. If you've ever had the experience of going into a restaurant and feeling like you were invited into someone's home, you've experienced great service. So we try to do that, but we also try to create community within our staff, because great restaurants always have that community, family feel. That's the only way we can share that same feel with our guests. And I think that having had Lainey at our restaurant and having her grown up there also added to that sense of community.
I just want to point out that Lainey's actually sitting here with us. So, Lainey, can you come over here and give us your impression? Can you give us your first impressions of the restaurant? Did you even know it was a restaurant? It was like, or did you think this?
Well, it was like, I mean, it was my home. I think, yeah, we spent way more time there when I was a kid, and still do, at the restaurant than we ever did at home. And I knew everyone. I made tortillas with the tortilleras. I mixed drinks.
How old
drinks.
Were you when you were doing that?
Oh, three, yeah.
I would, on Saturday morning, sit behind the bar.
I can't believe this was really true. I tell that story
don't
now, and I
do
think,
this
what
at home.
What kind of mother was
but
I?
But I used to mix drinks behind the bar.
Made with lemonade.
Okay. But I used to make, like, we have limonadas, and I used to make them behind the bar on Saturday mornings.
And what did you think of that? Your friends at school were all out doing something else, and you were behind the bar.
But it was, I loved it. I mean, it was, and I never really had, I mean, not that I didn't have a choice. I could have gone and done whatever I wanted, but that's where I wanted to be. And like when I go home now, as I live in New York, and so when I go home to visit, I still spend all my time at the restaurant. Like, I'd much rather be there than sitting at home by myself.
Why? Why do you think?
Oh, because as the restaurants have grown and I've left and grown up, I don't know as many people, but I still know 75 to 80-90% of the staff at any given time. And so I just go and, like, you know, it takes me an hour to get through the restaurant because everyone stops me and we have 10-minute conversations, and it's my family. They're my family, and they're my best friends, and they're who I grew up with. It's nice because I don't have siblings, so they are all, yeah, and I...
So you recommend it because
I do. Oh, 100% recommend.
Because I was at a women's cherry bomb conference a couple weeks ago, and they had Suzanne Goen and Gabrielle Hamilton talking about being working mothers in a restaurant and how hard it was. Now, their kids are very young still, and you could see they were going through the pains of it. And I don't think they chose to bring the children into the restaurant per se, but they were saying how hard it is. But I'm happy to hear. We just know there was always I was in your restaurant when she was young, and it just gave the restaurant another dimension. That it was a real family dimension, and you felt it among the staff, too.
Well, and over the years, customers' kids would come in, and they'd go to Lelaney's room and play with
them. Oh, yeah, I had friends that were, kids. And sadly, not a lot of them come in. They've all moved away and stuff now, but, as have I. Yeah. but, yeah, so I grew up with these kids, and there was a group of three of us that were all around the same age that were kids of people that worked there.
Did you feel it was your restaurant?
Not really. I never felt like I felt like, yeah, I was part of it, but I never felt any sort of ownership or better, like, you know, I never was above anyone. I was
them. I don't mean like that, but that was your stake.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I know my daughter feels like this is her school.
Yeah.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, very protective.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So...
Well, there was one key we haven't mentioned to how we made this work, and that was when she was 8 months old. So for 8 months, we both took care of her while we were working. And obviously sleeping a lot and everything. But then we hired someone to take care of her who worked with her at the restaurant. So she was a restaurant, so she was part of the restaurant world. She did other things around the restaurant too, and she worked with her there. So we would come there, her nanny would come to the restaurant, take care of her there. Her nanny would take her out to the parks and to the children's museum and all this kind of stuff, eat with her and all this, but they were always there, so we were always in and out.
And the other thing that we did as a family, which I thought was really important, and I think it's really a thing to keep in mind if any of our listeners are thinking about going down this path, is that we sat down and had a meal together every day as a family, but not at the restaurant. We had breakfast together, and we prepared things. And we sat down, and Deanne would have flowers on the table and light candles, and we would have this. It was a simple breakfast, but that's what we would have. That was our family time away from the restaurant, and there was, to me, some solidity in that it created. Yeah. Our private family time, and it's really, and I hear a lot of chefs talk about how hard it is to ever get a meal with their family because their family wants to eat dinner, and of course the chef's working during dinner, so how can you do it? But I remember hearing Madar Jaffrey talk about this really early on, that she was a stage actress before she became the famous cookbook author and everything. And worked on Broadway, and she would have to go to the theater at night. So she would, every night, she would come home from the theater at the end and cook dinner. And they would have the kids stay up and do all these things because she wanted to make sure that they had their private time together. And that's how she got into cooking so much, was that she would every night come home and prepare this meal. And even if the kids had been asleep, they'd get up and they'd have this dinner and stuff like that. So I found that really interesting, and I thought we should have that in our family in some way, so we did it with breakfast.
You integrated Lainey a lot, even into the media.
Yes.
That you did. Was that conscious, or did you think, it brings a different perspective? Why did you bring Lainey into the TV shows?
Everything that we have done we have tried to make it in human scale, make it feel like that, oh, you can do this. So our TV shows from the very beginning were set up so that they were half filmed on location in Mexico to show you what my inspiration is. And then the second half of the show is done in our home kitchen, not in a restaurant kitchen, but our home kitchen, to say to our viewers, you know, you could bring this into your own family life as well. And it just seemed right that we would, that I would integrate Lainey into it, because she's part of my family. And we still do this a lot when Lainey comes home, that we'll prepare a meal together. We usually have a bunch of people over that all want to see Lainey and stuff, but we'll spend, you know, a whole day making a meal, and we all work on different aspects of it. And Deanne is just sets gorgeous tables and has always been focused on that sort of stuff, but Lainey and I will be cooking together. Deanne will come into the kitchen and help us with prepare things, but we have tried to always integrate cooking for our family and friends into a family activity. And so it just seemed right to put that in the television shows as well.
And I also liked it and wanted to do it.
Is there anything you would have changed?
About my growing up? No, not at all.
Do you feel like you were privileged?
In an interesting way. I feel like I was very, very privileged to have, like, this huge family of people. Like, for all intents and purposes, I had a 100-person family that were all the employees at the restaurant. And what's great is that most of them have been there since I mean, we have how many, like, 25-year people and stuff like that who are older than I am. Mm-hmm. And so they were around before I was born. And I would not have changed a thing. I feel very privileged to have, and especially it's sort of being an only child, too, and also being from a relatively small family. Like, neither of their families are particularly big or, you know, and are also scattered, so it's not. I look at them as my family, and I feel very privileged to have all of them.
I know you studied theater at NYU.
Yeah.
Do you have the food bug, too?
I do. A little. I studied theater, and so when I moved to New York, I was, you know, going through college or whatever, and was not particularly happy. I didn't necessarily love NYU, and I was struggling a little bit and really was homesick all the time. And the thing that got me through it was that I got a job as a hostess. And I worked in a restaurant, and I got this whole group of friends, and I, you know, I had somewhere else to go that wasn't school, and it was an atmosphere that I understood and made me really happy and that I loved. And I think that that is sort of was the telling moment to me, that I, as much as I love theater and as much as I love directing, which is what I focused on, I really love this more and want to be part of it.
Whoa, you're going to see generational, get another little, well, you're still young, but there might be another little storage room coming. Well, we've run out of time, and I'm labeling this part one.
Okay.
Because we've got to get into we've just scratched your life. But this has just been fantastic to have the whole Bayless family here. And
fun.
I think it was
fun.
Just so, you really are iconic. You're as a family, as chefs, talents, hospitality, leaders. And I think it was a really important conversation today, because I know a lot of people are out there, and not just in our food world, but in many worlds, on how do you juggle this work and life balance. And my hat is off to you.
Thank you. I think it's a very, very important thing for us to talk about with people that are in the profession, thinking about going into the profession, because it you hear all these war stories, and I always say you can forge your own path, and you can make something that's right for you, but it's really great to hear how other people have done it to give you some perspective. So it was a real pleasure to be able to share all of this.
All right. And I love your daughter.
Thank you.
You know you have great restaurants?
Thank you.
You make better parents.
That means more to me than anything. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, listeners. And I want to have a shout out to Robin Cohen and Jack and his my producers. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.